start from the beginning of the Sedra. Says Laman Tesaper Ba'ozne Bincha Uben Bincha. Part of the miracles that happened in Mitzrayim were not necessarily to punish the Egyptians or to get the Jewish people out of there. All of it could have happened differently. But in order that there should be a basis of emunah in Klal Yisrael that can be passed on from generation to generation, of things that happen publicly that serve as the foundation of our emunah. And the Torah describes it as telling it over to your children and your grandchildren. Ba'ozne bincho ben bincho. So the Sefer Apirion ala Torah, which is from the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, Shlomo Gansfried, the same author as the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, he has a Sefer called Apirion. He asked the following question. If every father has to tell his son, then what's the purpose of telling your grandchildren? Your son will tell his son. So you could say it's talking where the father is no longer here, so the grandfather has a responsibility. Others say that since this whole idea is an idea of tradition, a link in the chain of tradition, hearing it from the grandfather is one step closer to the source. So there's an idea that the grandfather should also be involved. Even if the father tells his child, the grandfather should also be involved. The Apirion says a different idea, and it answers a question I had also. And that is, why does it say, Laman Tesaper Ba'ozne Bincha, in the ears of your children? Right? The Torah didn't tell me to tell it to his ears. You tell it to his big toe? I mean, of course you tell it to his ears. Where else are you going to tell it? Right? What does that mean? Ba'ozne Bincha. Tell it to him in his ears. You don't whisper it in his ear. It's Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim. So what the Apirion says is the following. He says there's really no responsibility for a grandfather to tell his grandchild. It's not what it means. It means you have to tell it to your child in a way that he will be capable and interested to give it over to his children. You have to tell it to your child in a way that it'll get to your grandchildren. Because the purpose of this is not to tell a nice story. It's to create a link in a chain of tradition. So if you tell your child in a way that he will not pass it over, excuse the pun, right, then you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah. The mitzvah is not to educate your child in what happened in Mitzrayim. It's to create a link in a chain. And therefore, you have to tell to your child, and it will get to your grandchild. That's your responsibility. In that case, it answers my question too. Why it says, Ba'ozne bincha. The Ritva says that that which we say in the Haggadah, Keneged Arba Bonim Dibra Torah, right, is not to tell me that there are different kinds of children, they ask different questions, they get different answers, but it's to tell me a halacha, that unless you tailor-make Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim to fit the intellectual and emotional state of your child, you don't fulfill the mitzvah. Because the mitzvah, again, is not to tell a generic story. The mitzvah is to imbue the child with the interest and the capability of giving it over to the next generation. And therefore, different intellects need different levels of story. If you tell a chacham what's fit for a tam, you're going to bore him to death. And if you tell a tam what's fit for a chacham, it's going to go over his head. And if you speak to a rasha like you would speak to a tzaddik, you're not going to get through to him. And the opposite is also true. So therefore, you have to know who your child is, what combination of children you may have, because children are not black and white either. Sometimes they're a chacham, sometimes they're a rasha, sometimes they're a tam, and sometimes they're an einu your daily show. And sometimes they're a combination of all of them. So you have to listen to them and hear from them, right? What did they say? It says, chacham, what does he say? He's really asking. But through the question, you get the idea of who he is. Right. What kind of answer that's befitting him? And that's why it says, Ba'oz, you have to put it and tailor-make it to the ears of your child. You can't just say a story in the air and hope everybody will catch on to it. But it has to be tailor-made to go into the ears of that child specifically. Right? And because the purpose, again, is not education per se. The purpose over here is creating a link in a chain for the future. Okay. Next. The Torah says that during the plague of darkness, two things happen. One is, aside from the Mitzrim being paralyzed, but the Jews had a chance to go into the homes of the Mitzrim. For them it was light. The Mitzrim couldn't see what was going on. They couldn't move. And they checked out the houses. They didn't take anything. But they knew where everything in the house was. Later on, when they went to borrow the gold and silver vessels from the Egyptian neighbors, so the neighbor said, "We don't have such a thing." He said, "Yes, you do. It's here in this place or whatever." And they said, "If you knew where it was, why didn't you take it?" He says, "We're not got nothing. We're coming to take it either as payment of our wages. You had us work for you for 210 years, and we would like our back wages." Right? Or, by the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they went and borrowed it, not saying specifically they're going to return it, giving that impression. For whatever reason God had that he wanted to fool the Egyptians too and make them think that they're going to get these things back. Whatever it may be. That's God's business. He's the one who commanded us to do it. But the Gemara says that we had a right to demand it, that they owed us back wages for 210 years of free labor. In any case, that's one thing that happened. That's not what I want to speak about. Second thing was that there were Jews who had to die, who were not going to be taken out of Egypt. Now, those Jews, l'cha'ora, were not the ones who were wicked, who were served Avodah Zorah, because Jews who served Avodah Zorah also went out. It says before Kriyas Yamsuf, the Malach of the sea didn't want to split. And he said, "Why should I split for these and not for these? Halalu of the Avodah Zorah, they're both idol worshippers." That means that the Jews that went out were also idol worshippers. So who didn't go out? How bad did you have to be not to get out of Egypt? So I saw recently the Kliyoker Taka says, that was something I always thought, but I never had a source, but now I see the Kliyoker says it, like matter-of-factly, the ones who didn't go out are the ones who didn't want to go out. They were so assimilated to Egyptian culture that they didn't feel there was any place to go out to. They were Egyptians. So God said, fine, you want to be Egyptians, you want to stay in Egypt, because they said, hey, but alive, you can't stay here. So you can be buried in Egypt. Those are the ones who didn't go out. The ones who wanted to go out, who felt themselves different than the Egyptians, still maintained an identity of being Klal Yisrael, right? They were able to go out. People who lost that identity completely, totally assimilated, didn't feel that they were anything more than Egyptians, stayed in Egypt.
What was Am Yisrael
told would happen? What do you mean told would happen? No. They were told by Moshe Rabbeinu they're going to Eretz Yisrael and they're going to get a Torah. All these things were told when Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to go to them. He was supposed to tell them that after 50 days they're going to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam on this mountain. You're going
to
get
the...
What? No, no. There was no other. The option was you're leaving here. You're a nation that's going to Eretz Yisrael, right? Mekayim the Shvua that God. No, no, they didn't want to leave there. They felt they were Egyptians. The fact that they were slaves didn't bother them. In fact, one of the evils of that the Rebbeinu tried to take them out of was Sivlos Mitzrayim. They were able to patiently suffer in Egypt and not feel that they were suffering anything. This was became their normal lives. So when they were able to be Sovel, they were able to take it and not to feel anything's wrong. You know, this
including
is
the baby son,
what?
Including
including that. Right. You know, that's part of, you know, maybe they deserve it. They looked at themselves. They looked themselves as Egyptians. They looked at these other people as, you know, the Jews that are giving us problems. They haven't assimilated, and these non-assimilated Jews are the ones that are problems. It happens all over throughout history. Okay, in any case, so that's not the point I want to get into. But in any case, let's first get to, so I just want to establish who didn't go out. Okay. So, and they were not a few people. According to some opinions in the Gemara, In the Medrash, there were 4/5 of the Jewish people didn't make it. Only 1/5 went out. Okay? There's even bigger numbers than that. But let's say that's the pretty much more popular view. 4/5 died during Choshech. Okay. So God used the Makkah of Choshech to kill them under the cover of darkness. Why? Because he didn't want the Egyptians to see Jews dying. Millions of Jews were going to die. They shouldn't see them dying because they would say, you see, it's not just us. Jews are getting it too. So obviously, what's it called? This is not God's doing. It's some kind of, you know, major plague or whatever that doesn't, you know, discriminate against anybody. So Jews are also dying. It would have taken away the message of what Yetzias Mitzrayim was. So God killed them under the cover of darkness, and that was that. You have to understand, how's that going to help? If 5-10 Jews died, then it's possible, before the lights went out, right, there were 600,000 male Jews, and now 10 died. So nobody ever knew about it. They didn't see them dying, and they died, and they were buried and finished. But if 4/5 of the Jewish people died, that means before lights went out, there were 3 million men between 20 and 60. Now the lights go on 6 days later, and there's 600,000 men. Right, 2,400,000 Jews are disappeared. Right, where are they? Hiding under the bed. And lo and behold, the cemeteries are full. Now you don't have to be too smart to deduce what happened.
And that these people. Right?
What?
Mitzrayim did not die.
No, there wasn't a plague to die. Right.
But then I wouldn't think that was a regular plague. Only the Jews
died. Whatever. No, whatever. It would seem that it would be even worse, right? That Jews are dying. What you call Jews are being affected by this too, and here only specifically Jews. So the question is: so what did it help? What difference did it make if the Rabbanu Shem did it where people could see or under the cloak of darkness? Lamaisa, in the end, it was clear what happened. The Egyptians knew that 4/5 of Jewish people died. So you can't cover up 4/5 of the people dying. So what did it help to do it during the darkness? Well, the answer is that there's a very big difference between, we are people who are affected by our senses. What we see, seeing is believing. Right? What you see may not be more true, but it makes more of an impression. If you see it or if you just hear about it. The difference between experiencing something with your senses or knowing about it intellectually. The difference, they used to say in Tells, is when they paint these park benches and they put a sign on it, wet paint, right? You walk into the park, you see these green benches glistening with a sign on it, wet paint. What's most people's reflex action? Put your finger on the thing and look at the paint on your finger. Why? Don't you believe the sign? Don't you see that it's glistening? But that's intellectual. When you feel it on your finger, you experience it. It's real to you. Okay? The Sefer Ikarim says that Moshe Rabbeinu heard blow by blow what was happening at the foot of Har Sinai with the Chet HaEgel. Yet he didn't break the Luchos when he was up there. But when he saw the Egel, that's when he broke it. Says the Sefer Ikarim, because what you know, even God tells you, you know it, but it's not the same thing as seeing it. Seeing it, not that he believed it more, but it made more of an impression on him. When you see it with your own eyes, it makes more of an impression. And then he was moved to break the Luchos. In addition, he didn't want to break the Luchos up on top and then let the Jewish people know that there were Luchos and they were broken, because they would only know that intellectually. He wanted to see him break the Luchos. Same thing, same idea. So therefore, had Paro seen Jews dying, it would have made a greater impression on him and nullified or balanced out or decreased, minimized, mitigated the effect of the Makos of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But if you had to deduce it intellectually, it's not the same thing anymore. Right? It doesn't make the same impression. It doesn't mitigate so much what's going on. You know it intellectually, it's not the same thing as seeing it with your senses. Okay. Okay, let me tell you an interesting drasha. This is a different kind of learning, right? There's pshat, right? There's drush, there's remez, there's sod, four levels of understanding the Torah. One level is called drash. Drash means it really has nothing to do with the simple meaning of the sentence, at least on a simple level. But it's something that you can learn from the sentence that is extraneous to the simple meaning. Okay, the drash is not the simple meaning. When I tell you, you'll understand what we're talking about. The pasuk says like this: Paro says you can go, but leave your cattle here. I want you know a guarantee that you're coming back. So you leave your cattle here. Moshe Rabbeinu answers and says, "V'gam miknenu yelechimanu. We're taking our cattle. Lo sishoer parso. We're not leaving one hoof. Why? Ki mimeno nikach lavodas Hashem. Because from that we are supposed to take to serve God. We don't know what sacrifices. God said we're supposed to go 3 days in the desert and serve Him. Now we don't know what sacrifices. How many sacrifices? We may need our whole entire flocks. Maybe He's going to demand from us to kill them all." We don't know what this service to God is until we get there. So we got to take everything with us. That's what Moshe tells him. That's the simple meaning of the pasuk. Comes along the Elif HaMogen, who is the author of the Pele Yoetz, Rabbi Lezer Papo. His sefer, Pele Yoetz, is a much more well-known sefer. But he has a sefer on Chumash called Elif HaMogen. And in there, he brings down this drash. Again, it has nothing to do with the simple meaning of the pasuk. Okay? It's just a takeoff on the words of the sentence itself. So he says like this. He says that if you want to look at this sentence in a homiletical way, we can butcher it the following way. Okay? He says that, you know, people spend most of their time in this world working for this world to earn a living. Right, to pay their mortgage, to buy clothing, to eat, physical material things that you can't take it with you. Right, those things, when you die, you leave here. Tachrichim don't have pockets. Right, you can't take it with you. So isn't it a shame that people, most people, spend most of their time in this world involved in things that are not going to be able to be taken with them to the next world, and the things that they're involved with the next world are a minimum of their time. Such a shame. He says, however, there is a prescription how you can take the things that you're involved in for this world for the sake of the next world too, and take it, you can take it with you. That's what he says this pasuk alludes to in a drash. How? V'gam miknenu yelechimanu. Even our material possessions, miknenu, can go with us to the world to come. You can take it with you. How? How can you take and convert the time that you're involved and the things that you do to secure a livelihood in this world, and you can turn it into something that's eternal and take it to the next world? He says, you have to follow the pound prescription. If you want your material possessions to go with you, then you have to do the following. First, lo shisha'er. So he cuts it two words together. Instead of lo shisha'er parsa, not one hoof will remain. He takes those two words together. Lo shisha'er. Take all the lows. Don't steal, don't cheat, don't lie, right? Don't take interest, all the things that could be wrong with earning a living in a prohibited way, shisha'er, leave it to the side. Don't be involved in anything that is illegal. Lo shisha'er, leave the lows on the side, don't transgress them. First thing, earn an honest living. That's the first condition. If you don't earn an honest living, then none of this will apply, and you won't be able to take your time and efforts, right, for securing a living to the next world. You may take it to the next world, but not the place that you want it to be. Okay, so that's lo sishoir. Next thing, parsa. He splits the word parsa into two words. Pros he. Cut off five. Set aside five. Pras, paros means a portion. Take five portions, meaning the following. Even though most of your day is involved in earning a living and pursuing material and physical things, set aside 5 times in the day for spiritual pursuits. 3 times a day you daven, and 2 times a day you learn Torah. Once in the daytime, once at nighttime, right? Vagisa v'yom v'layla. Set a little bit of time aside in the morning or in the day. Set a little bit of time at night and learn Torah. Right? Don't make your day completely devoid of Torah learning or of davening. So 3 times a day daven, 2 times a day learn, 5 times a day you're involved directly in spiritual pursuits. Next condition. So that's the first condition. Earn an honest living. Set aside 5 times during the day to be involved in spiritual things. Next. Ki mimenu nikach lavodas Hashem. Have in mind when you are involved in your material pursuits, you're earning a living, you're involved in whatever material things, that you're doing it for the sake of serving God. I'm working so I can pay my bills and I can have a house where I can have a shir. I have a house where I can be machnis oreach. I can have guests. I have a house where I can have a place to sleep and eat or whatever, so I can serve the Rabbanu Shalom with a good, clear head. Because if I didn't have a house to live in, I was a homeless person, I wouldn't be able to have the peace of mind to be able to do anything properly. I'm earning money so I can send my kids and pay their tuition. I'm earning money so I can have the wherewithal to buy an esrog and lulav and Shabbos meals and whatever else is. I need all of that. I'm basically doing it as a preparation for service to God. And the Meiri points out, different thing, that what you do in preparation for a mitzvah is part of the mitzvah itself, meaning the following. That it says that whoever eats on the 9th day of Tishrei is like he fasted 2 days, Erev Yom Kippur. If you eat Erev Yom Kippur, it's like you fasted 2 days. He says, what does that mean? It's if you eat Erev Yom Kippur, it's a mitzvah to eat, so it's like you ate. Why is it like you fasted 2 days? So he says the following. He says the preparation for a mitzvah is part of the mitzvah itself. When you're building a sukkah, there's no mitzvah to build a sukkah. If you have a ready-built sukkah, you can just the mitzvah is to dwell in it during sukkahs. But if you don't have a sukkah, you have to build it. So when you're building a sukkah, which mitzvah are you involved in? The mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah, except you're involved in the preparatory stage of creating a sukkah that you'll be able to live in. But that's part of the mitzvah. Part of the mitzvah of dwelling in the sukkah is preparing a sukkah to be able to dwell into. Okay. So it's part of that mitzvah. He says the Torah said that you should eat Erev Yom Kippur because it wants you to be able to fast on Yom Kippur without being so upset with not eating that your mind's going to be on your stomach the whole day and not on what Yom Kippur is all about. The Torah wanted you to fast on Yom Kippur so you wouldn't be involved in concentrating on your physical things. You'll be able to concentrate on spiritual things. But if you don't eat Erev Yom Kippur, you're going to be so hungry on Yom Kippur that all you're going to think about is your stomach. So eat good Erev Yom Kippur so Yom Kippur won't be totally oppressive and you'll be able to concentrate on spiritual things and not be involved in the physical things. That's the ideal. So therefore, when you're eating Erev Yom Kippur, what mitzvah are you involved in? The mitzvah fasting. You're just preparing for it. And preparing for a mitzvah is part of the mitzvah itself. So it's like you ate, you fasted 2 days. Because the first day you were involved in the preparation for fasting, and the second day in the actual fasting. And the preparation for fasting is part of the mitzvah fasting. So it's like you fasted 2 days. That's what he says. Memela, a person who, when he's working, when he's involved in his material, physical things, has in mind, I'm doing this in order to be able to serve Hashem. I'm doing this to be able to learn Torah. But if I don't take care of my physical, material needs, I won't be able to learn the Torah. I won't be able to observe the Torah. This is a necessary preparation for all of that. Then the time that he's preparing is considered like he's learning and like he's observing the Torah in that time too. Okay, that's why I like to explain the following Tosfos. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin that the first thing a person is judged on in the next world is Torah learning. That's the first thing you're judged on. Did you spend time learning Torah or not? And how much? Yet the Gemara in Shabbos says that when you come to the heavenly court, they ask you 6 questions. The first question is, did you deal in business honestly? Second question is, did you set aside time for learning Torah? So Tosus asks the obvious question. If the Gemara says the first thing you're judged on in the next world is learning Torah, then why would they ask you first about your business? And then about your Torah, first they should ask you about your Torah and judge you on that and then ask you about your business. Tosus says, Enochanani, the first thing you're judged on is Torah. But the first question they ask you is about your business. Then they ask you about your Torah. Then they judge you on the Torah. And then they judge you on other things. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make sense. Why in the world would they ask you first about your business, then about Torah, and then judge you on the Torah first? If they judge you on the Torah first, they ask you about the Torah first. According to what we just said, the answer is very simple. Because a person, let's say you had a chance to learn an hour a day. Okay? So he thinks, after 120 years, they're going to ask him, did you set aside time for learning? He said, yeah, I set aside an hour a day. And that's it. But that's not necessarily the case. Because if the person had in mind, when he was conducting his business, was involved in his material, physical things, that he's doing it in order to be able to learn that hour a day. Because if he doesn't earn a living, and he doesn't have a house, and he doesn't pay his children's tuition, he's not going to be able to learn an hour a day. So all of this is in preparation of being able to learn that hour, then the 6 hours that you're involved in earning your living count as 6 hours of learning, because they're all preparation for the learning, and the preparation counts as part of the mitzvah. So first we have to ascertain how you did your business, because if you did it properly, then the time you were involved in that may be considered learning time. And the opposite is also true. If you were learning all day, but when it came to business you were a cheat or whatever, then maybe that invalidates your learning completely. Maybe the way that you got to learn was through cheating, stealing, or whatever. Maybe, like you said, it's a mitzvah of aver. So we can't ascertain how much time you actually learn until we first ascertain how you did your business. After that, we can decide if part of that business time is going to be considered learning time, or because you did your business in a suspicious way, part of your learning time is going to come off. So we can't really judge you on Torah until we first ascertain how you did your business. So if that's the case, that's the next condition. Umimeno niki, mimeno nikach levodas Hashem. Have in mind that you are going to use what you are earning and involving your time in to serve Hashem. Okay, that's your intention. That's your goal. Then he says the following. He says, if you follow that prescription, then va'anachnu lo neida, it's impossible to know, ma navodis Hashem, who really is a server of God, ad bo'enu shama, till we get there to the world to come. Meaning, it's very possible that somebody who sat and learned all day, and somebody who followed this prescription, he worked 6 hours a day, learned an hour a day, but he did it with the right intention, that they may be on the same level. Even different. Maybe the person who learned all day, who wasn't honest or whatever, will have less than an hour a day of real learning. And this guy at least has 6 hours because his work time also counts as learning. So he may be superior to the other guy. So therefore, we don't know. Only God can know, only we can ascertain that in the next world. Who is on a higher level? A person who follows this prescription properly, or somebody who sits and learns all day? Maybe the person who sits and learns on a higher level, because he does it with the right intention, and he's learning all day. Right? But we don't know. There's no way of knowing until Ad Bo'enu Shama, till we get to the world to come.
Would it be correct to say that proper hachana for a mitzvah creates the thing to receive the bracha of doing
mitzvah? I don't know if it creates a kli to get the bracha, but it definitely makes the mitzvah more quality mitzvah. A mitzvah that you don't prepare for properly can't be a quality mitzvah. The Chiddush Yarim says that Shiluach HaKein is called a mitzvah kala. It's an easy mitzvah. So the Gemara says, because it doesn't cost anything. You don't have to spend anything. Right? It's not your bird, not your eggs. You're just sending away to mother and getting the eggs. So that's a mitzvah kala. It doesn't cost. But he says, the Chiddush Yarim says, it's a mitzvah kala because you can't prepare for it. It says, ki kore, if you chance upon it. A mitzvah you can't prepare for can't be a quality mitzvah. It can only be a mitzvah kala. The more you prepare for something, think about it, have the right intentions, the more quality it's going to be. Memela, the reward's going to be different, and the bracha you get from will be different also. But because it's more of a substantial thing, because you prepared for it. Okay, next. It says that the... Va'ani etain, what's it called? First of all, the Rav Shem says to get gold and silver and clothing from the Egyptians, and to put the clothing on your kids. And the Gemara says, why did God make them go get gold and silver? It's in order that Avraham Avinu shouldn't say that you fulfilled when you foretold to Avraham Avinu that his children are going to be slaves and strangers and oppressed. You fulfilled that beautifully. But the Achrei Chen Yetzu B'Rechush Gadol, and after that they're going to go out with great riches you didn't fulfill. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu went to the people. God said, Abir Noba, plead with them that they should go take gold and silver in order that Avraham Avinu shouldn't have complaints against me, that I didn't fulfill the fact that I said they would go out with great riches. So a few questions here. Quite a few questions. I hope we'll have time to answer them all. First question is like this. God said that they're going to be oppressed and so on and go out with great riches. What difference does it make if Avraham Avinu has complaints or not? God has to fulfill his word. They have to go out with great riches. Secondly, and it says, Daber no, plead with the people to go and take the gold and silver. You have to plead with people to go get gold and silver? It's free, free for all. Right? Whatever you take is yours. You have to plead with people. Some say, yeah, you have to plead with them. Because when something becomes a mitzvah, even if it's getting gold and silver, people have a million reasons why they want to do it. Right? Something could be the most logical thing. I remember in Miami, there were goyim who used to buy in the kosher butcher shop because they felt it was more hygienically kosher is better. Right? It's cleaner. Right? That's what they thought. And yidden who wouldn't go near a kosher butcher shop because I won't eat kosher food. Right? Once there's a yetzer hara, right, the most logical things become a million reasons not to do it. Okay. So, therefore, you have to plead with them even to get gold and silver. But why does it depend on what Avraham Avinu is going to say? God has to fulfill his promise. So what does Avraham Avinu have to do with it? So, and secondly, if God wants to fulfill his promise to give them riches when they go out, why does he have to get them to go and get it from the Egyptians? Their pockets with gold and silver. Let it rain down, gold and silver. Why do I have to go bother them to go get it? I was thinking the idea is the following. The Medrash says that Avraham Avinu was asked for his opinion of the following. God said there is a blemish in the Jewish people which has to be eradicated. There's two ways of doing it. One is they should go through the bondage in Egypt, and that will eradicate that blemish, or they can eradicate it later on in the next world, right, in the world to come. Avraham Avinu, according to one opinion of the Medrash, chose bondage in Egypt. Better get rid of it here than to leave it for the next world. So let them go through bondage with it. So Avraham Avinu chose bondage for his children, but he knew that it was for their good. It was going to take away this blemish, like an operation. So really, when God said they're going to go out with great riches, he didn't mean gold and silver. He meant that they'll then have that blemish taken away and they'll be able to get the Torah. But the Dubna Magid gives the following marshal. He says there was once a five-year-old who was an expert violinist. And what's it called? A child prodigy. And he was hired by a symphony orchestra to play violin. The end of the month, the head of the orchestra calls him in, gives him a beautiful check. I mean, for his kid runs home crying. I worked for a month playing my violin. They gave me a piece of paper. Father says, let me see the piece of paper. He looks at the piece of paper. He says, a nice piece of paper. He says, you give me the paper, and I'll take care of it. Puts the paper in an account, in an escrow account, you know, for his kid. He calls up the symphony, the orchestra leader. And he says, look, my kid doesn't understand checks, money. He understands candy. Next month, call him in and tell him, here is your wages for the month and a big bag of candy. Send me the check. I'll put it in an account for him. When he gets older, he'll appreciate that his candy was not what he got. he'll appreciate all the money in the bank that he earned. But right now, he's a little kid, and he understands candy. He doesn't understand money. So too, says the Dubna Magid, when God said that the Jewish people will leave Egypt with great riches, he meant the Torah. But the Jewish people were very immature at the time. And if you would have told them, okay, here's your great riches, they would say a piece of paper, the Torah, that's our great riches. They were on the level where gold and silver made an impression. So God will fulfill his word by giving them the Torah. But Avraham Avinu, the father, is going to have tainus. What are you giving them something that they don't understand? This is great riches. So for the sake of Avraham Avinu, God has to give them the gold and the silver that Avraham shouldn't have tainus. You fulfill with them their being strangers and slaves, and that they understood. And the riches, you didn't give it in a way that they could understand it. So that's why it depended on Avraham Avinu and not necessarily on God fulfilling his thing. But the question then is, so why couldn't they just get it? Now, the answer is because they had to realize that they gained something from being in Egypt that they wouldn't have gained had they not been there. If God rained gold and silver on them, they could have gotten that without being slaves in Egypt. But getting it from the Egyptians themselves, hold the question, getting it from the Egyptians themselves, right, made them feel that they gained something from being in Egypt. And then they'd understand that maybe they gained more than just the gold and silver, but they gained something in how the Jewish people developed and that blemish going away, and then they would appreciate what Avraham Avinu chose for them. So it's a whole process of recognizing that they gained something from Egypt that they wouldn't have gained had they not been there. That the purpose of being there served the purpose also. It wasn't totally negative. Now, the question is, okay, so gold and silver. How about the clothing? Why did the Moshe want to take clothing and put it on their children? So the Kliyoker says that the clothing wasn't really part of the command. If you look, when Moshe Rabbeinu was told to begin with what was going to happen, God said, you're going to go out with great riches, gold, silver, and they're going to get also clothing. When he commanded them, he didn't command them about the clothing, but when they left, they took the clothing. So the Kliyoker says like this, the command was to take gold and silver, but when they went to the Egyptian homes to get the gold and the silver, the Egyptians offered them clothing. Why? Because the Egyptians at that point knew that their firstborn were dying, and they assumed it was a plague. In a plague, the first thing you do is burn the clothing, because it's contagious. So they were very nice, and they said, you're taking our gold and silver, why don't you take our clothing too? Hoping that the Jews would get infected. So God said, don't worry, you can take the clothing. There's no plague over here. I killed the firstborn. Take the clothing, put it on your kids, not dangerous at all, no problem. That's a kliyoker. I have a different shot. The Rabbanu Shalom, just let me finish so we can get the idea, because otherwise we're not going to finish. The Rabbanu Shalom wanted the Jewish people to know that that things that are prohibited are dependent on time and place. That for 210 years, one of the merits they had was they didn't wear Egyptian clothing. And now they're going out, and God says, take the clothing, put it on your kids. What kind of chinuch is that? So I want to tell them like this. The clothing, intrinsically, there's nothing wrong with it. V'horaya, if it would be shatnez, or it would be natsonua, they couldn't put it on their kids in the desert either. So it must be intrinsically okay. But had you worn that same clothing the last 210 years in Egypt, you never would have gone out. Why? Because wearing it in Egypt is to be like an Egyptian. That's treif. Something can be intrinsically 100% okay in one place at a different time. But in that place, at that time, it has implications, something that is not Torah, the opposite of Torah, then it's Asur. The example, even Torah can become Asur. How? When the Haskalah, right, said that Torah Sheval Peh they don't believe in, and it's a waste of time, but they didn't want to give up the Torah completely. They weren't ready for that. So Torah Shebichsav, Tanakh, that's what they made the Ikar. So Tanakh became a symbol of a rejection of Torah Sheval Peh. In the yeshivas, they stopped learning Tanakh because Tanakh became a symbol of something negative. So even the Torah can become, if used in the wrong place, the wrong time, right, in a certain place, in a certain time, that becomes a symbol of something negative, then it's awesome. And in a different place, in a different time, maybe 100% okay, right? if in Eretz Yisrael a certain style, right, is 100% okay, tznius wise, but it represents a certain culture, then you can't wear that. Even though in another time or another place it'd be 100% okay, it doesn't signify anything.
It's like in the sukkah they use colored light bulbs. If they come from America,
right? Right, exactly, exactly.
It
could be in Yerushalayim where there are no Christians and the Yerushalmis never saw a Christmas tree, that those are sukkah decorations. And you use the same sukkah decorations in America, they have an implication of something different. Yeah, and a phenomenon.
When
actually
selling little Santas in the
black, I was sure, the first year I came here, we'll end with this. The first year I came here, so I decided that I want to become more Israeli, so I'm not going to decorate my sukkah with my sukkah decoration I brought from America. I'm going to get rid of them, and I'm going to buy all Israeli sukkah decorations. I went to Meir Shorim, and I see on the tables, it looks very familiar to me. I get closer, and I see it's extremely familiar. It says Merry Christmas on the wrapping. It's Christmas decoration, and they're all buying it. I was sure I would go to Lamoid and see a sukkah decorated with a little baby with some shepherds around or whatever. They tell me, see, ganze mishpacha, really nice. You should know, in one of the Beis Yaakovs in Kiryat Sefer, so they have, you know, when you're holding on the phone, they have, you know, the music. And between bells, instead of bells, you know, to tell the kids when to go to class, they have the same music that goes through the thing. They were playing Jingle Bells. They had no idea what it was or whatever. So sometimes it's much worse. I mean, people walk around here with T-shirts in English that they have no idea what it says, right? And it really says really not nice things. And so from people, what's it called? We're around with a T-shirt. And my daughter went over to her and she said, you should know what it says on that T-shirt is really, really not nice, right? So I didn't know it. That looked to me okay. So in any case, yeah, what in one place, here they'd have no idea that those have any association with anything that's not Jewish. Yeah, whatever, but it's still not for a Beis Yaakov, you know, that is the song that could have been Silent Night, too.
Can I ask a question about gold? Because I don't understand that whatsoever, because the
was made to him as the progenitor of the Jewish people.
But riches, not gold, right?
Yeah.
And the whole message, right, of Torah is, and the problem of the Egel Azov is that they value gold in Egypt. It didn't work. So they certainly could have been given the message that it isn't gold which is riches, but it is Torah. Because that is.
Yeah, but they really weren't holding by that. In any case, they could understand you're going to be given gold, silver, you could use it to build a Mishkan too. You could use it to become to rehabilitate yourselves. It was 210 years; they had nothing. Now,
what?
Yeah, no, no. So therefore, it could be the Rebbe Mishlam promise that you're going to go out with great riches. He meant the Torah, right? But at that point, the Jewish people would say, "Hey, we had this prophecy, and it wasn't fulfilled. We didn't get great riches." Right, it was only later they got the Torah, and even then they had to be understood that that was called great riches. So just to placate, you know, what's it called, at the time, that they shouldn't feel that they were cheated, that somehow the prophecy wasn't fulfilled, for the, in their eyes, what they understood it, that's what the Dumnag is saying. Give them now temporarily.
Can you explain why it was okay
to sort of lie to the Egyptians? Many say that part of it was punishing them in kind. Again, we didn't lie by choice. We lie because God told us to lie. If they lie. Right. Because part of what the Egyptians did to us is lie to us to make us slaves. That they took advantage of us and made us feel like fools. Part of their punishment was to have the same thing done to them. Mida k'neged mida. That was part of the punishment of the Egyptians. You enslaved them with guile, you're going to be punished with guile too. Not just you're going to be punished, you're going to be had too, just like you made them had. That's some say.